grown-ups know how important it is to get a good night's sleep. Well, if that's the case, why aren't we making sure our kids get an adequate amount? Welcome. We're glad you're a part of the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Tell me how many times you've said this phrase. I just want to get a good night's sleep. That's all I want. I myself have only said it a few hundred, if not thousand times. So on today's program, we're going to talk sleep, but we're going to aim it for the kids, and specifically trying to change the school schedules for the kids so they can get more sleep. Now, many say, look, it's the right thing to do, but logistically and from a money viewpoint, there are plenty of hurdles, and we're going to get to those in a moment. The discussion will start in just a minute or so. Before we get started with that, I want to mention that September 11th, 9/11, is this Wednesday. As part of our program on Wednesday, we'd like to include your thoughts and remembrances of that day. Where were you then? How did the terrorism impact your life or the lives of your family members? Freshmen in college this year never knew the world that existed before 9/11. Think about that. How do they and how do you see the world nowadays? We'd like to hear from you. Please call us. Leave us a voicemail. Our number is 833-CALL-TFS, which is 833-225-5837. Or you can send us an email with your comments, tfs@wshu.org, and we'll get them on the air this Wednesday. Now, for our program today, we have a number of great guests for our discussion, which I hope doesn't make you sleepy. I know it's lunchtime and you just had lunch, but please stay awake. Let's start with Dr. Craig Canapari, director of the Yale Pediatric Sleep Center, and he's a member of the Start Schools Later campaign. How are you, doctor? Thanks for your time today.
I'm great, Ron. Thanks so much for having me on to talk about this important topic.
It's our pleasure. It is important. And doctor, before we begin, what age groups are we talking about?
Well, when we're talking about healthy school start times, the kids that tend to suffer are kids who are in middle school and high school. And the reason for that is generally younger children are hardwired to get up to go to bed early and get up fairly early. But when children move into puberty, their biological clocks get set around 2 to 3 hours later, so which would be fine, except here in the Northeast, and in fact in most schools in the U.S., school tends to start earlier the older you are. So essentially, we're setting kids up for sleep deprivation.
So, doctor, just as background, I just got my only one off to college this year, so I'm well acquainted with what you were talking about just from the last few years. And it's difficult across the board. You talk to the parents, all of them, and they all say my kid has trouble getting up in the morning because they are dealing with so much more nowadays than I think what we had to back in our day. And the stress and the late night studying seems to go on forever.
I do think that that is true, and you know, I'm not an educator, so I always want to say I'm not as up on the trends in homework, et cetera, as I am on the biology of sleep. Certainly, I think kids that are college bound do tend to have a much higher burden of schoolwork, though some research that I've read does suggest that the overall average burden of homework hasn't increased that much. But in the kids who are college bound, that has significantly ratcheted up. Not just the homework. It's also, I think, the expectation of how many extracurriculars you need to be involved with.
Absolutely. That's a huge part of the problem, because when you go for the college admissions and you're meeting everybody, they want to know what clubs you're belonging to. How many athletic activities are you involved with? It is just so much more than I think it was done years ago. But let me get back down to the brass tacks here. When should school start? How much later should they be, do you think?
Well, the American Academy of Pediatrics has recommended that no school start before 8:30 in the morning. Although if you read their policy paper, they say for some districts, 8 a.m. may be okay. And the way that they arrived at that is it's expert consensus, looking at the effects that that's happened when districts have changed start times later. And there have been many benefits for teenagers in terms of increasing the amount of sleep they get, and then the downstream benefits of increased sleep, which include improved health, reduced vulnerability to stress. I mean, there's lots and lots of benefits of getting enough sleep at night. I think the challenge is this is an issue that was generated when school districts started getting larger and you had to bust kids to different schools in a district, right? When you've got a one-room schoolhouse, it doesn't really matter. All the kids can start at the same time. But with the suburbanization of America, all of a sudden you've got elementary schools, middle schools, high schools, and the districts do not want to pay for a school bus, you know, to move all the kids at once. So that's when they started staggering school schedules. Now, not every district does this. A lot of urban school districts all start at the same time because children either take public transportation or walk to school. But in the suburbs, and you know, there's a lot of suburbs in Connecticut, they have to stagger it for cost reasons.
Doctor, do you have any numbers as to how many school districts have done this, have increased the times around the country?
Well, I can tell you just in the past, this fall, 22 different districts are doing it. I'm not sure the overall numbers. This really started in the late 90s in Edina, Minnesota, where a superintendent named Kenneth Dragseth worked with some researchers at the University of Minnesota because he noticed that the students were very tired, and they did a pretty drastic change, I think from 7:30 to 8:45. And what he described was the students were much less stressed. There was less trash in the hallways from kids eating candy and drinking soda to stay awake. And parents, even parents that are against it, came to him and they said, you know, you gave me my kid back, because I assumed that, you know, he or she was just kind of miserable because they're teenagers, but they were actually just really, really tired all of the time.
It's for those who live in a district where this has been done, I know that it can be difficult because you're talking about changing schedules, changing contracts, mealtimes, buses. Is it only that wealthy districts can do something like this?
No, I mean, actually, Minneapolis did it in the late 90s. And again, if children are taking public transportation, it's easier to do. Here in our state, in the state of Connecticut, Wilton did a pretty significant change in the early 2000s. They went to 8:30, and then they had to dial it back a little bit to 8 a.m. Greenwich 2 years ago actually went from 7:30 to 8:30. And one of the big concerns that came up in that district was the effect on sports, right? In the Northeast, it gets dark pretty early during a lot of the seasons, and some sports have to happen outside. Not every district has a bunch of lighted fields. And what they found so far is, although there were some challenges around practices, their athletes have actually performed very well the last couple of years and have taken home some state championships. So I think that certainly there's a significant amount of inconvenience that goes along with changing a start time.
I was going to say, but isn't it difficult? I know you're talking about schedules and meeting, but if your town is the one in the middle of many and you're the only one changing, it's almost as if this should be done, I don't know, on a regional basis or a countywide basis. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I totally agree with you. And in fact, in California, they passed a bill in 2018 called SB 328 to mandate that all California schools started after 8 in the morning. It was vetoed by Governor Jerry Brown, and it is going to be coming back to the desk of Governor Newsom. I can tell you, Ron, I have traveled to districts throughout the state speaking about this issue. And every district has its own set of concerns. The busing, I live in Guilford. And Guilford is the size and shape of Manhattan. So it's about 13 miles long, north to south, but not very wide. So the bus rides are pretty long. And we managed last year to get the start time changed from 7:25 to 7:40. It was a modest change, but it was a start. We were hoping to get about 10 minutes of busing efficiency as well, which we were unable to achieve. I honestly don't think that it was enough, but having worked on that for 5 years, I know that it's complicated. The issue is that this really is a health issue. Just because districts have their hours set up in a certain way, essentially they are balancing their school budgets, their busing budgets specifically, on the idea that the high schoolers start first. So the high schoolers have significant health physical and mental health consequences, and in some cases, academic consequences, which enable the districts to balance the budget. So one of the big objections is money. So sometimes getting more buses is clearly very expensive. Sometimes you can flip-flop school schedules, so have some kids going, younger kids going in earlier. Sometimes you can shift everything later. The other objection is frequently sports, but don't get me wrong, sports are very important, but really, if you had poor quality air in your school or poor quality water, you would fix it regardless of the cost. This is an ongoing toxic exposure causing sleep deprivation to many teens. So I think that if you think about it as the framework of a health issue, it's easier to get your head around why it's important and why there needs to be a change.
Doctor, we're just about out of time for this segment. If a listener would like more information about the Start Schools Later campaign, how can they find it?
I think the best place is actually startschoollater.net. They have a lot of great resources and information there, and it's kind of a clearinghouse both for research and news around this topic. And I really appreciate your taking a look at it. I look forward to listening to the rest of the hour.
Dr. Craig Canapari is the director of the Yale Pediatric Sleep Center, and he is a member of the Start Schools Later campaign. If you want to comment on today's program, please email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. And on Facebook, you can find us at Full Story WSHU. And remember, all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the full story on Google Play or an Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or Spotify. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. We're going to return now to our topic today, which is about sleep and about our kids and school times. And I'd like to welcome two guests to our program. Dr. Lauren Hale is professor of family, population, and preventive medicine from the Renaissance School of Medicine at Stony Brook University. Dr. Hale is the founding editor-in-chief of Sleep Health, Journal of the National Sleep Foundation. And Dr. Jennifer Papa-Kanan is assistant professor at UConn Medicine, and the doctor specializes in sleep disorders. Dr. Hale, Dr. Kanan, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hello.
For having us.
How are you? Dr. Hale, I'd like to start with you.
Sure.
Because, look, what happens to our brains when we don't get enough sleep? I for one, know that it's impossible to speak on the radio. I mean, I can do it, but it's it's more gibberish than usual, if you know what I mean. What does lack of sleep do?
Right. So first, I'm glad to hear that we're in agreement. We know that scientists, and apparently you, know and have known for years that insufficient, low-quality sleep is associated with a range of cognitive and health outcomes. Since the focus of this show today is about teenagers, it's important to clarify that what we know about adults is true, but teens are even more vulnerable than adults are. And the range of categories in which we see adverse outcomes for teenagers include behavioral problems, concentration, attention, risk-taking, mental health problems, including substance use, depression, suicide, unsafe driving, more car crashes, poor athletic performance. And for the issue of school start time, we also see lower academic performance. So it's a long list, but all thoroughly researched. So the evidence is pretty clear that poor sleep is detrimental to the teenage brain.
But Dr. Hale, why are teens more vulnerable?
Several things are going on. And I heard your earlier guest, Dr. Canapari, talking about the phase delay that naturally happens physiologically to teenagers. As teenagers enter puberty, their biological clock is pushed later. So they're staying up later. There's not much we can do about that. Of course, as parents and families, we can work together to contain that, but we can't have them going to bed at 9 o'clock like some of the younger kids. And this is coupled with a terrible crunch that high schools frequently start way too early for the teenage community. So we've got two things going on. The later bedtimes due to increased autonomy and phase delay among the kids combined with the earlier school start times. So both ends of the scheduled sleep time are impeded upon.
Dr. Kannan, and am I pronouncing your name correctly? And if not,
yes, you are.
Oh, excellent. I have to say, and I think everyone would be in agreement on this, academics should always be number one, right? A kid goes to school to get an education. But so many kids do so many other activities. Tell us the impact sleep deprivation has on those activities.
So I'm glad you brought this up. You mentioned that you have a child transitioning to college, and I think I'm the parent of four adolescents, and I understand, you know, the societal pressure to perform well so that you get into a good college. If you haven't gotten a good night's sleep, you're actually going to have a poor performance on the athletic field. We also, as your previous speakers have mentioned, we notice behavioral problems. People have problems with relationships, both with their teachers, their friends, their parents. So it can have far-reaching consequences.
And I have to say that watching my son and the others who were on his team when it came to test time and staying up late and studying and then trying to watch them the next day as they engaged in those team activities, there's no other way to say this. They looked like a bunch of old men out there. They were all just dragging and they couldn't do anything. And the coach would be looking at them going, what's wrong? And I'm looking at the coach saying, they're exhausted. They need sleep.
Did you say that?
Sure I did.
Illustrate the importance of sleep. So there's a decreased risk of injury for those students that are getting an adequate amount of sleep. There's improved reaction time. One study that was out of California showed with a tennis team, they had improved sprint times. They had improved hitting accuracy. So you're really going to develop a better athlete if they get a good night's sleep.
Dr. Hale, but what if one of the other towns, let's say your school district says, look, we're going to do this. This is important. What if the other towns around you don't do it? How do you convince them? Because it seems to me that it needs to be done on a regional basis.
I agree. And I've encountered this on Long Island where I live, is that the distance between schools that compete in athletics against each other can be far. East Hampton competes with Jericho. That's a long distance on Long Island. And in order for that school district to end their school day in time to go meet with other school, they do struggle to meet those times. But as you stated already, I believe academics should be the primary priority of the school board and the superintendent and the teachers. And there are ways to work with other schools. We should all be moving together to agreeable times so that we can play sports together.
Dr. Kannan, what about for those teachers who live outside the district who have their own kids who then have to then go to the schools that haven't changed the time, but they work in a school district that has started later? I mean, this really can play havoc with schedules, can't it, and family life?
Absolutely. As I mentioned, I'm a mom of four, and I work as well. So child care is a challenge, and it continues to be a challenge. I think, you know, as your first speaker alluded to, I think we really have to get our head on straight, and we really have to think about what biologically makes the most sense for these kids. And most teachers, I think, would say that they want to do the best thing for their students. And so really it should be more of a national priority that we focus on improved school start times for adolescents.
Dr. Kannan, I just want to know what the trick is to having four kids and you have a job and then you get enough sleep. I mean, what's the trick?
I have a lot of great babysitters. So I have to say.
Good for you. Can we just talk a little bit about those who maybe are nationally well known? And you know, I'm thinking about some of the athletes that the kids admire. Around here, you have Tom Brady, for instance. And I know Tom Brady he's a little bit older. He takes really good care of his body. But one of the things that he stresses is sleep. And I know LeBron James, the great LeBron James, supposedly travels with his own mattress because he insists on getting at least 8 hours, if not 10 or more hours of sleep during the season. It seems to me that it's happening now with people that the kids actually know and admire. Dr. Hale?
Oh, I completely agree. Another well-known athlete is Roger Federer, who apparently sleeps or reports sleeping up to 12 hours a day, including a two-hour nap, which seems biologically difficult to me, but I'm impressed. So this is an opportunity for leaders in athletics to speak to kids about something where they want to excel. My colleagues at Stony Brook and I conducted a study looking at the Twitter feeds of NBA basketball players for 7 years, and we showed that shooting accuracy increased by, I think it was 2 percentage points, not 2%, so it was like 2 percentage points, by simply seeing if that particular player was up late at night tweeting the night before their game. And if they had put their phones away early, they performed better than if they had been up late tweeting.
Wow.
And this, you know, this is the type of work that speaks to teenagers and maybe adults too. And if we can convince families to put their phones away, to charge them in a central place where there's no room for binging on a Netflix show or getting interrupted by a text or a Snapchat in the middle of the night, we hopefully can at least minimize the many temptations that can keep us from our precious sleep.
So, Dr. Kanaan, let's talk nuts and bolts, because many of us are addicted to our phones, and kids take their phones with them to bed. Yeah, how bad is that?
It's not good. And it continues to be a challenge. You know, we don't live in a perfect world. I don't have a perfect household, and I struggle with this as well. As Dr. Hale mentioned, having the phones charged in a central place so you can check in on the phones is important. Remember, your teenager is still growing and developing. They haven't developed a lot of those critical thinking skills, and they don't have a lot of experiential learning to build on. And so you really have to continue to parent your adolescent. That's very important. The screens emit a blue wavelength of light that resets your internal clock. So some of those biological changes that we've discussed earlier in the program that really describe how adolescents like to stay up late, that pushes their bedtime even further along. So it really has to be something that you prioritize. You prioritize taking away the smartphone so that the child gets sleep. And really, you have to highlight with your children that sleep is not a luxury. It's a necessity, and you need it to recharge. Just like your phone has to get plugged in, you have to get plugged in. You have to get sleep.
So, Dr. Kanaan, how long should they be off their phones and their computers before they go to sleep?
So most experts recommend that you turn it off at least an hour prior to bedtime. Sleep is important, as we mentioned, and the phones stimulate you from blue wavelength of light, but then also it's very exciting when you're on social media sites and, you know, you're chatting with your friends. It's very exciting and it's very stimulating. And then it's hard to wind down once you've had these really emotionally charged conversations. So you want to allow time for your teenager to wind down and invite and not demand sleep.
Dr. Hale, I found this a little bit earlier today when I was reading, and it said, in a 2014 study involving 100 middle school athletes by the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, those who slept less than 8 hours per night were 1.7 times more likely to have an injury than those who slept for 8 hours or more.
Right. Well, this speaks to how we know that sleep benefits all aspects of functioning, and that includes your coordination and your processing speed and all of these factors. So to minimize accidents and injury, please give your children the rest they need. Help your children get the rest they need.
Dr. Kanaan, I think some of the kids, some of the teens that I've known for the last few years, they would like more sleep, but I think they almost feel guilty about it because of our society, that if they're not staying up and doing more or being part of some groups, they're kind of failing and not getting ready for college.
I'm glad you brought that up. So I think it's so important as a parent to role model good behavior and to really provide your children with the confidence they need. And it's important to talk about how life is not a sprint, it's a marathon. And you've really got to set yourself up for success. And one of the ways that you can do that is by building good habits that will take you through your college years, young adult, through adulthood, and as you continue to get older. And so as a parent, what you have to do is you have to role model good behavior. You have to continually reinforce healthy habits that include healthy sleep habits and talk about those cornerstones of healthy living: diet, nutrition, exercise, and getting enough sleep.
So if the kid sees mom or dad on the desktop or the laptop and working and returning emails at 11 at night, that's sending the wrong signal completely.
Correct.
Dr. Hale, what do you say to those who say, look, this sounds great, we would like to do it, but our district simply doesn't have the money to do this?
There have been several studies that show that the long-term economic benefits of delaying school start times to the recommended 8:30 or later actually outweigh the initial costs. And sure, there will be costs in figuring out the revised bus schedules. Maybe you need to get new buses. But if we see improvements in performance, academic and otherwise, we can imagine this having a much bigger impact than simply the initial costs. And also, I would say, seek help. Many other counties and school districts have been able to make this work. Fairfax County, Seattle City Schools, and many other around the country. And schoolstartlater.net is there to help. And there are many resources and people that you can talk to try and help minimize the burden to the residents. This is something that will require change, but hopefully it will, almost surely the evidence suggests it will lead to change for the better.
Dr. Kanaan, that's what someone said to me just the other year. They said, look, it's going to cost us money now, but the test scores are going to go up. Because of that, people will be more attracted to the town because the schools will be better. That'll mean housing prices will go up. Everybody will benefit economically.
Correct. And, you know, another thing to focus on is improved psychological health, reduced car crashes. So school districts that have changed school start times have noticed a dramatic decrease in car crashes by teens. And that's really important to remember. I remember that every time I'm on the road. Gosh, I hope they got a good night's sleep.
Mm.
So we can see that, you know, in terms of suicide prevention, in terms of the treatment and of anxiety and depression, prevention of car crashes, sleep plays an important role. It also plays a really huge role in students making appropriate decisions in terms of early sexual encounters, early alcohol use. They tend to make the right decision and choose to wait on those things if they've had a better night's sleep.
Sleep is the cure-all, huh?
That's what my kids are always accusing me of.
It sure helps. It's not the only thing, but it's a good thing.
It's a good thing. Okay, Dr. Hale, we only have about a half minute left. Final thoughts, please.
I'm just thrilled that so many communities are working together right now. In Stony Brook, Three Village District is working on this. In the state of California, we see legislation in the works. And I feel like we're at a turning point, and I'm optimistic that school districts across America are going to do the right thing.
Dr. Kanaan, final thoughts, please.
I guess my final take-home point is really to drive home the message that sleep is so critical. It's not a luxury. And it's important as parents to ensure that our kids are getting a good night's sleep. And one way we can do that is readdress with our school district school start times.
Dr. Jennifer Papakanaan is assistant professor at UConn Medicine. The doctor specializes in sleep disorders. And Dr. Lauren Hale is professor of family, population, and preventive medicine from the Renaissance School of Medicine at Stony Brook University. And Dr. Hale is the founding editor-in-chief of Sleep Health, Journal of the National Sleep Foundation. Dr. Hale, Dr. Kanaan, it was a great conversation. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye.
I'll speak with you soon. It's the full story on WSHU. When we come back, the president of Wesleyan University, Michael Roth, will be joining us. Stay with us. We were just talking about students and sleep, and now we're going to turn our gaze to when they're a bit older and they're in college and they're expressing themselves and their political beliefs. The issue of free speech and political correctness it's been a hot topic for decades, and it is certainly hot nowadays in our current political climate when even adults have trouble talking about politics. Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University, and he is the author of Safe Enough Spaces, a pragmatist's approach to inclusion, free speech, and political correctness on college campuses. President Roth, welcome. Thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Sir, why did you decide to write this book now?
Well, I've been observing the kind of tidal wave of complaints about young people today and about political correctness, about issues concerning affirmative action and free speech on campuses. And although I do think that there are improvements we can make on college campuses in regard to all of those topics, it did seem to me that there was kind of the cultivation of panic that somehow young people today weren't like kids used to be when we were great kids. And so I thought I try to weigh in a way that recognizes that we have improvements to make, but that we actually have to meet students where they are and not leave them where they are, to help educate them about these important issues and learn from their perspective.
Every generation believes they're unique, don't they?
Well, some more than others. I was in college in the 1970s, and there had been a real tidal wave of criticism against the boomers when they got to college, and that was all blamed on Spock, and Alan Bloom blamed the decline of standards on everything from rock and roll to Friedrich Nietzsche. And today we have social scientists and pundits finding reasons to despair of the young. And I think that, as you pointed out in your introduction, older people are having a hard time with free speech and civility. So I think we have to work harder to open the minds and the hearts of our college students and not so much complain about why they're closed.
So you mentioned that you went to school in the 70s. And going back, I remember the riots at Columbia University and in Central Park and, growing up in New York. And I've witnessed this since the 60s. But nowadays, it seems more contentious. Why is that?
You know, I actually don't think it's more contentious. I think that it may be a greater surprise to the generation of parents today that young people are not exactly like them. I think my parents didn't expect us to be like them, that they took for granted a kind of generation gap. But there is some expectation today by people in their 50s and 60s that, young people should have the values we had because we taught them those values to the young people. And there is some of that. I asked my students just a few weeks ago here at Wesleyan who their moral heroes were in a class on virtue and vice. And the most popular category were my mother and father. So I think there is an expectation that students will be like we were, perfect in every way, as that old song went. But in fact, students have a different perspective because they're in a different economy. The culture is quite different. And of course, their means of communication with one another is very different than it was when I was in school or than you in school.
President Roth, you address this in your book, Safe Enough Spaces, but some conservatives claim that college campuses stifle the conservative viewpoint. Are they correct?
Well, I think it's overblown, but I do think that there is a tendency among faculty members to add more value to the kinds of ideas that are like their own, and those tend to be on the left, like my own ideas tend to be. And when this was raised to me by some colleagues and friends at Wesleyan, and I started paying more attention to it, it did seem to me that we had to be very proactive in bringing conservative ideas, religious ideas, libertarian ideas into the conversation on campus. We couldn't just depend on the marketplace of ideas for this to happen. Otherwise, you get these provocateurs who just come to campus to insult people and yell and scream. You want serious study of alternative ways of thinking about culture and society. And I do think that leftist professors can teach conservative texts, and I teach texts from different religious traditions that are not my own. But I being mindful of our own biases is an important quality of any teacher. And I have asked my colleagues on the left and elsewhere to actually make a real effort to integrate the study of conservative ideas and religious ideas, because they're part of the spectrum of human experience, and we avoid them at our peril. We're just not very good educators if we avoid them.
In your book, I like the way you put it. You said, try to understand the other person's logic. But that's difficult at times, isn't it? When you're sitting there and saying, okay, I should just listen now.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, I just came from a class on Aristotle, and my students would naturally just say, well, Aristotle says this, but I think he's wrong, and here's what I think. And I've told them in the beginning of the class, and I know it's a little insulting for some of them, I don't care what you think in that respect. I want you to tell me why Aristotle thinks as Aristotle does, and try to figure out the logic and the rhetoric and the point of his arguments before you tell me your judgment. Hmm. And the reason we do this is not because I expect them to be experts on Aristotle or next week Aquinas, but because it's a way of modeling listening. You could be critical, but you can also try to understand why someone expresses herself or himself from their shoes, from standing in their shoes. And that's an exercise in humility, but also in generosity. And I think that we can model that in our classrooms rather than asking students to be quick to judge or quick to make strong conclusions.
I like that. You're telling them, take those extra few steps before you make any type of judgment.
Yeah, and I tell them you shouldn't care what Roth thinks about Aristotle. I mean, you know, Aristotle's been around thousands of years. Who cares what Roth thinks? Let's try to figure out what Aristotle thinks. Even if in the end we conclude, or they conclude, that they don't agree with something, it's more interesting. It's a more interesting way to live, to pay attention to how other people think, especially when they don't agree with you. It's too easy to try to understand the other guy when the other guy has the same views that you do.
Right.
And I find the students are very receptive to this. And, you know, here at Wesleyan, which is definitely a politically engaged campus, and many of those students might protest one of my decisions as president, but as students, they're completely open to thinking through the logic of other kinds of ideas, as long as a teacher helps them get there.
President Rutley, you brought this up a few minutes ago, and so I'd like to go back to it. Some families have been, and I could say I know some families who have been torn apart by this. The politics of the last few years, it makes family politics, the family gatherings, very uncomfortable. And I've even heard that some hosts have told people when they come to their house, look, no political talk. We're just not going to talk politics. So if so-called adults can't do it, then how can their kids do it?
It's hard. I mean, I do think that taking a step back from the hot button issues and trying to understand the context for them and what's at stake in those issues leads to very positive discussions. And then you can understand why someone comes to a different conclusion than you do. But you do that not by talking about, Trump's latest policy or the AOC's latest recommendation. You talk about the principles that are at stake there, principles having to do with education or equality or citizenship. And those things can, what happens is you realize that reasonable people can disagree. And I do think that in our public culture, we've lost some of that notion that reasonable people could disagree. And part of that is because, I do think, is because the President of the United States practices a politics of cruelty and lying that makes it very hard to actually have an authentic conversation. I've never said that about a previous president. I haven't always agreed with their politics. But I do think we're in a world now where the government is run by people who have little respect for education or for the process of inquiry and conversation.
President Roth, you've said that your students are receptive to what you're saying, and they're very open and they're willing to engage. How are your faculty members receiving your message?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have had very good conversations with my colleagues who don't agree with me that, in some cases, that we have to correct for a bias to the left. But in my view, it matters less whether they think I'm right than that they're willing to engage in the conversation. My view is, optimistically, I suppose, that if people start talking about biases, even if they don't agree on the solution, they'll be more aware of those biases. And these are good people. They're professionals. They don't actually want to be biased. So even if they think, Roth, you're wrong to call for an affirmative action program for conservatives, which is what I've done, that the fact that they're engaging with me in the debate, having a discussion about it, talking with their students about it, I think it opens the door to looking at things from a variety of perspectives. And that's what I'm after.
You know, President Roth, along those lines, I read a column in the New York Times the other week where the writer had a line which basically said, progressives are the new Puritans. And that struck me. Was she correct?
I don't think so. I've read those kinds of things, too. I mean, there are often people who take political views that others think of as extreme who get labeled Puritans because they become intolerant. I suppose that's what they mean, of other points of view. And I think this is a highly polarized moment in American history. And if you don't agree, you can get called a traitor or, and from the other side, a racist. And I do think there's some of that. But I don't know that having been pilloried on Fox and Friends this morning myself, I don't think that it's just progressives who are doing that. I think that sometimes people who thought of themselves as liberal get annoyed when they're criticized by progressives. But that's bound to happen. It happens to me all the time that I'm not progressive enough to say for some of my students. But I don't think that authoritarian streak is particularly present in progressives. You see it in the president of the United States, who, if you are disloyal, will ensure that your career is cut short or that you are denied support from the government. And so I don't think that's only on one side of the political spectrum.
So I didn't realize you were on Fox and Friends this morning.
Well, I wrote an op-ed in the Times last week, and they decided to attack it on the air this morning, as Breitbart did over the weekend. Which, you know, I think that's fine. It's good to know who one's critics are, and but they didn't ask me to talk about it. They asked somebody who was just critical of the piece I read, which was really just arguing, as I do in the book, that you don't want spaces on campus to be so safe that people don't have intense discussions and disagreements, but you want them to be safe enough so that students aren't harassed by their professors. They're not beaten up because of their race or ethnicity or sexual orientation. You want certain kinds of safety, but you want it to be safe enough. But you don't want it to be nobody wants it to be so safe where there isn't disagreement. And so that's the position of the book. I kind of play with this idea of the good enough parent that came from psychology in the 50s, that the parent who didn't make you crazy.
Yes, and I so remember that.
The space should be safe enough so you don't get beaten up because, let's say, you're gay, or you don't get hit on by your professor because you're a woman. They should be safe enough, but they should also be open enough that people can really express themselves without fear of retaliation or harassment.
I have had some say to me that they are so afraid because of the sensitivity that seems to exist in our culture nowadays. They are so afraid to say anything that they simply don't express themselves at all. They just refuse to engage because they figure someone's just going to get so ticked off it's going to cause an argument.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because is the problem that person doesn't have enough courage to speak, or is it the problem that someone might criticize them? I actually think the problem is that the person doesn't have enough courage to speak and is afraid of getting yelled at. And that is a problem, but it's not a problem that someone may criticize them. It's a problem that they're so afraid to speak. Now, I say in my class that, you know, we have about 80 students in there, that some of us are going to say stuff that turns out to be wrong, or maybe even offensive. And so our rule in the class is we're going to cut each other slack, that we're going to have, you know, we'll point out when people make mistakes, or we'll have vigorous arguments, but that we're not going to attack each other personally. And there is no dispute about that. Everybody likes those ground rules, and people eventually are willing to share things that are very personal, their religious views, their political views, their questions about race, gender, and ethnicity. That doesn't happen all the time. I don't want to make it sound like it's paradise. But I think people just have to have the courage to speak up and know, yeah, somebody's going to yell at you. Somebody's going to criticize you. Yeah, so what?
It's part of life.
If you have a point of view, yeah, Speak up. And I think we can model that on campuses more effectively.
I agree with you. I mean, if you have a position and if you've thought it through, you were talking about logic before, and if you have the logic to back it up, why not express yourself, as long as you're not being hateful or mean? But if it's your position, it's your position.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you the example at hand. I've been urged by other people in my world of college presidents, don't do radio shows. People are going to attack you on the radio, and sometimes it's a call-in show, and people do call in and say, Roth, you made this dumb decision 2 years ago or whatever. And that's fine. I mean, I think it's you have to be prepared to be wrong. And, you know, I don't engage in discussions to prove I'm right. I engage in discussions because I may be wrong, and I would like to find out if I'm wrong. And if I could show my students that that's actually a fun way to live, it's a more meaningful way to live, and they can join in their own fashion.
With the minute that we have left, are you optimistic with what you're seeing on campuses nowadays?
You know, I have to be optimistic because I see students who have enormous talent, the capacity to work harder than I could ever work now, and they're in their 20s. And what they need is some instruction to turn their talents and energy to deal with the extraordinary problems that my generation has left them to deal with, from climate change to inequality. We need their help, and I am optimistic that they'll do a better job than my generation did.
It's a great book. I know that we have an advanced copy. Is it available for everyone nowadays?
Yes, Safe Enough Spaces. It's available wherever you find fine books.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University and the author of Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist's Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. Thank you, Mr. President. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
We'll speak with you soon.
Bye-bye.
Once again, I would like to remind everybody that September 11th, 9/11 is coming up. It's going to be this Wednesday. And what we're doing is we're asking for your remembrances. Where were you that day? Family members, what have you thought since then? Have you changed the way that you live because of all the security checks? Does it bother you when you go over the bridges and you see the police cars lined up making sure that the bridges are safe? Or when you take the trains or go to the airports? How has your life changed since then? When you think back to those horrible days, what do you remember? Leave us a voicemail, 833-CALL-TFS, 833-CALL-TFS. That comes out to 833-225-5837, or you can send us an email, tfs@wshu.org. We'll get them on the air this Wednesday. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Franks, the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangare, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks for listening, and thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.